Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where hopefully the intelligence comes from my guest, and this time it's Janet Yang. I've known Janet for a long time, and let me just begin by saying she's probably most famous for having produced a movie called, based on the book by Amy Tan, called The Joy Luck Club. Let me just say, you're someone who I always thought of as American as apple pie. You're just like me, a product of immigrants. You're not yourself an immigrant, right? Is that not true?
That is very true. I was born in New York. However, I have spent a pretty good chunk of my life in China.
No, I'm
so
good. That's why.
That's what distinguishes me maybe from another typical ABC, as we like to be called.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we don't like to be called. Other people like to call
what
us
ABC.
What does
ABC stand for?
American-born Chinese.
Oh, okay. ABC. But what is interesting, because I have known you for a long time, you didn't know Mandarin or Cantonese for that matter until you went to college.
That's true. I went to China for the first time in 1972.
Well, let's go back to college, though.
Okay. Yeah. But 72 is before college.
Oh, before college. Sorry.
So it was the trip in 72, which I think is essential in understanding why I decided to take Chinese. It was obviously Nixon and Kissinger's historic visit. That was the year where it took place. And so I grew up with very little exposure to or interest in China, even though my parents were from China. It was a very mysterious place, and my parents didn't much talk about it. And I didn't much ask. It just had seemingly no relevance to my life other than the chickens and duck that were hanging on our back patio, or a certain kind of household habits, you know, wearing slippers in the home.
And where was this where you grew up?
This was in a very Jewish community on Long Island. It was New Hyde Park. And we were the only Asian family in the school district. My parents moved there because there were good schools there. And I grew up thinking that all Americans were Jewish. That was my world. I went to bar mitzvahs and bas mitzvahs. And again, except for the fact that we ate, you know, foods that didn't resemble the fried chicken and spaghetti and meatballs that everybody else was eating. And the fact that my mother worked at the United Nations, so she had quite a wide array of friends from all over the world, and some family friends that they saw on weekends that were Chinese. My life was not really affected by China or any kind of semblance of Chinese, of a Chinese community. And my parents initially had every intention of moving us back to China. I think what changed their minds was in 1956, there was something called the 100 Flowers Campaign, and it was targeted really at intellectuals and foreign influence. So then they realized that it was probably not a good idea for them to go back to China. My mother at the time was working at the United Nations, and so they accused her of being a spy. We had relatives that were persecuted. All of this was not something I knew much about, but suddenly, one day in 1972, I get a call from my parents, and they said, we're going to China. When Nixon and Kissinger returned, and it was a trip that obviously that Kissinger helped set up first, the UN ambassador from China gathered all the Chinese nationals and said, we really sincerely want you to go visit your homeland. You've been gone from home for a long time. Apparently, he was a very charming man, and he convinced a lot of the Chinese working at the UN that it was worth it. They were scared to death. I mean, China was so closed off, but he managed to warm up a few people, like my mother, who had indeed missed her family very, very much. They never said a proper goodbye. And so we were one of the first families to go back to China in 1972. It was still the middle of the Cultural Revolution. And it was, in so many ways, a shocking and yet entirely life-changing experience for me, because I came to grips with the fact that I was indeed Chinese in many ways, that I almost grew up in China. I would have been a Red Guard, undoubtedly. I was just at that age. And I had dozens of relatives that were, you know, very close, first cousins and aunts and uncles, and I started to think about my parents' lives and what they left, how they lived, and the transition and, you know, adaptation they must have made to live in America and raise us three kids. And I just became fascinated by this country, which ostensibly couldn't have been more different than what I had known in America. It was very old, very poor at the time, and there was, you know, socialist realist music blaring from every megaphone. It was, people were dressed extremely uniformly. I got in trouble for taking pictures of a woman washing clothes in the river. There's so many things. I heard countless stories of things being confiscated and then returned, and persecution, and on and on and on. And yet, despite all of that, which seemed so alien to my teenage self, there was a familiarity, a warmth, something that just struck me at a kind of gut level that made me want to know more. It felt weirdly like a kind of a home of sorts. And I was embarrassed that I didn't speak Chinese. I felt like I should. I understood a little bit. But I made the determination at that point that I was going to learn Chinese. So years later, when I went to college, I did just that. I started to learn Chinese.
You went to Brown, and they had a pretty good Chinese program.
They had pretty good, but they didn't have a lot of other classes in Chinese studies. They had a good language program. Oh. So I ended up taking classes at Harvard as a visiting student for 2 years. I graduated from Brown, but it was the teacher at Harvard that I spoke to who was from the mainland. She was somebody I got to know quite well, who I said, please, I want to go live in Beijing. I want to work and live in Beijing. I don't know where I came up with this idea, but in 79, relations were normalized. I graduated from college in 78. In 79, relations with China were normalized, and it was the birth of the Deng Xiaoping era. And lo and behold, I found myself in March of 1980 on a plane to Beijing to work at the Foreign Languages Press, which was the official publishing arm of the government. They published books and magazines for export. You probably have seen some of them. You know, Peking Review, they called it China Reconstructs. I worked in the book section. So I had a very, very bizarre experience that today still leaves the deepest impression. I think about this period all the time. It was first of all, in terms of what was happening in China, it was historic. Every day, history is being made. It was the fall of the Gang of Four. It was the birth of the first capitalist company. It was called CITIC. I remember going to this press conference, and here was the Chinese government saying, we've decided to form a capitalist company, and this is our first capitalist, and his name is Run Yuren. Well, CITIC today is worth, I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever. Forgive me for not having that figure. But we were rolling our eyes at the time thinking, what do you mean? You don't just like form a capitalist company under a communist regime. It just, there were so many firsts, and everybody was watching with incredible just awe and curiosity about what was happening. There were artist movements going on. I befriended somebody who became famous for a short story that he read and that he wrote. They called it Literature of the Wounded. And there was this bubbling up of so much creative and intellectual foment.
Clearly, and we saw it in this presidential election, is a stereotype of China that is still quite robotic and manipulative of attributed to the Chinese, and they're hurting our economy. And you transitioned. You were actually at one point quite early on working with, I believe, Steven Spielberg and trying to get films in.
Yes.
Did that come at the same period?
Yes, this was this was after I did my year and a half in Beijing, and I came back and I ended up running. I didn't know what to do with that experience. I got a business degree, and then I was hired to run this company in San Francisco that was bringing Chinese films out. I was so inspired by the films that I was seeing in China, which featured Chinese people, obviously, in lead roles. I had never seen that before in America, and that a light bulb went off in my head that was, you know, where I thought, oh, it is possible for Chinese to be on camera. And I hadn't really thought about why we were never so in American films. And it just opened up my thinking about the power of media and entertainment. And And so I was running this company in San Francisco and taking Chinese delegations around and to film festivals and showing Chinese films and really relishing the opportunity to expose Chinese artists as well as humanize Chinese on screen to audiences. And then I was hired by the studios to sell American films to China because none had been shown in China for a long time. And then that led to a job working with Steven Spielberg on the movie Empire of the Sun, which was kind of an interesting golden period because, again, U.S.-China relations were warming. Bertolucci made the film The Last Emperor around the same time we were making Empire of the Sun in Shanghai. And things were looking pretty weird. That was many of us who experienced that period, the 80s, going back and forth to China, do have a lot of fond memories because it seemed like China was on a path of, and it was, of really opening up, and the possibilities seemed very, endless. And then, of course, in 1989, Tiananmen hit, which just changed the course of everything. And
the suppression of the demonstration in Tiananmen Square.
Yes, there was a lot of activity, and it really soured people's views on China. And there was a big chill in this country, and certainly in the entertainment industry. There are several films that then came out that the Chinese deemed unfriendly to China. One was called Red Corner, one was called Kundun, one was called 7 Years in Tibet, because anything to do with Tibet was not considered friendly. So I made the decision at that point to stay in Hollywood and really learn how to produce films, having had this amazing experience working with Steven on Empire of the Sun, but it no longer seemed wise to put all my eggs in the China basket.
And so, well, why don't we catch up on that part of your career as
okay.
well?
So in 1989, that's when I joined Oliver Stone after I'd done a stint at the studios at Universal and working with at Amblin. Then I joined Oliver Stone, and that 7 years that I was with him is during that period where I met you.
Yes,
and I
actually helped on a few.
You
movies.
Were working on some projects with Oliver, and that was also a.
Well, actually, just to connect the dots here, I worked on the movie Nixon, and my son Christopher, the two of us worked on rewriting the script, and had quite a bit of impact. And one of the things we were called in to do was flesh out the whole image of Nixon and this, not only the China scene, but Nixon is a more complex figure, and I think the movie was quite bold in that respect.
Oh, I think you did a great job with that, and Anthony Hopkins did that. You know, and I really continue to admire Oliver for having tackled these subjects that were so relevant but had not particularly been the kinds of subject matters that other directors wanted to take on at the time.
Let me ask you a question before we get to Joy Luck Club, though. In terms of film, you talked about how difficult it was to get any contact with Chinese film and the emerging film industry. Right now, we're at a point where China is the key market, isn't it?
It is. For the moment, it's the second largest market in the world. Everybody believes it will be the largest film market within a matter of a year or two. It's a little behind schedule because they had a really good three-year run, 2012, 13, 14, or I guess 4 years, 15. 2015 was amazing. 2016 hasn't been quite as strong, many of us believe, because there's been so much money getting thrown into the business and not enough good projects. So there's been a little bit of a feeding frenzy. And the audiences ultimately decide the quality of the films has gone down a bit. So ironically, one of the big issues between Hollywood and China is how many films are allowed in, and there's a quota. And so this year, because the local films, the domestic films, were not doing as well as they had in previous years, they let more American films in.
So not only we've gone from a situation when you were a high school kid where if you even talked about China, you could get yourself arrested, and there was no contact, and the question, can we ever recognize them diplomatically? And we've gone to a situation now where you sit around and you think about movie projects, you think about the Chinese market, And then, of course, in our overall economy, the Chinese seem to be underwriting our debt and funding so much, be a major exporter of products of any kind. It's the world's turned upside down. And the interesting thing about that is they're still communists. That had always been the big argument, you know, red or dead, or, you know, they'll never change, or how can we do business with them? They're communists. That was the whole thing. You can't negotiate. Well, these communists turned out to be very good capitalists, maybe better than us. And so then I have to ask you, where does communism meet capitalism? How do they make this marriage? I mean, think about it. You can actually make the argument that the best capitalists in the world now are communists. You know, how did that happen? I mean, Marx has to be turning in his grave.
It's definitely its own unique brand of communism / capitalism. I think of it as, well, first of all, the ruling party, the Communist Party, chooses to remain calling itself communist, I think, because they don't want to say they're having a change of government. They need the continuity. And they have had peaceful transitions, just as this country has had. In their case, there's not exactly voting in electoral college, but there is a system for politicians to rise, and they definitely want the stability of a continuous regime. And I think that has worked for China very, very well. The ideology is a different story. There's still centralized control, whether or not whether some ideologists would consider it pure communism or socialism. That's debatable.
I should say to people listening, this is an edition of Scheer Intelligence, Robert Scheer. I'm talking to Janet Yang, who produced the most important American movie about Chinese Americans, The Joy Luck Club, but also has a rich experience dealing with China on films, but also observing life there. And we'll be back in a minute. We're back with Janet Yang and another edition of Scheer Intelligence. And so where we left this off is, you know, not only we've gone through all the years of estrangement from China, and now we have a false familiarity, it seems to me. You know, obviously our smartphones are made there and there's a lot of connection, but there's still the inscrutable population that can be invoked in a presidential election, as we just saw in the 2016 election, and made a demon almost overnight, you know, that this they're cheating us and we have to be on guard against them and so forth. How do you assess this, the China baiting that came up?
I see a pattern of China baiting, China bashing, that has persisted for decades and decades. And China's always is a moving target, but it's always a target, it seems. And people get confused. That whole other part of the world, that whole Eastern Hemisphere, it gets all lumped together. You could say it starts, you know, it started back in the early 1900s when Chinese were coming over to be railroad workers, and they were actually legally, it's the only race that were forbidden from entering this country by legal means. I mean, it's really unbelievable. But you could point to World War II, even though China was on our side, but we were fighting Japan. You could point to what happened during the 50s with the Korean War. You could then talk about the Vietnam War. You could talk about so many points in history where America needed a boogeyman that was from Asia. And then you have the economic wars. It certainly hasn't helped that entertainment and media have really taken this by the horns. I mean, it's pretty shocking to look at old films and see how the Chinese were portrayed, basically. Either if they were positive Chinese in any way, they were played by Westerners, or if they were very, or even if they were negative stereotypes, they could be played by Westerners or Chinese. It was simply not a decent humanized version of Chinese to be found.
At best, they were inscrutable, was the word most used, but often presented as most dangerous. That was what was so significant about the movie you produced, The Joy Luck Club, because suddenly it was the first time a mass audience was introduced to the idea of Chinese people as American, first of all, born here quite often, fluent in the language, looking, you know, dressing like everyone else, not at all inscrutable, actually confused college kids and young professionals and so forth. It gave an opportunity to hire a lot of actors. Why don't you talk about the obstacles to making that movie, its impact, and, you know, and its lasting effect?
It's really a phenomenon. I'm quite surprised that here we are 20-some years later and there still hasn't been a movie like it, in the sense that it was a mainstream movie with a primarily Asian cast. It was pure happenstance how I got involved. I had been working with Amblin, and I went with Kathy Kennedy, who was running Stephen's company at the time, to New York, and we were visiting publishers looking for new material, and one of the editors at Putnam said, "Oh, we just bought a novel and paid more money than we have ever paid for a first-time novelist, and we haven't even seen the whole book. We only have these three discrete chapters that are not even related." And she specifically turned to me and said, you might really enjoy this. And I read the manuscript pages on the way back to LA, and I was so moved because I really had never seen anything that so closely resembled my own life, and I didn't even think it was possible. So many of us grow up in this kind of bifurcated existence. We have our private home life, and then we have our public life, and often the two just don't merge. So that was my experience growing up, is what I described, you know, to you earlier, the slippers, the chickens and ducks hanging, the Chinese food, the Chinese values, and the just that life. Others have written about it. Someone named Robert or Richard Rodriguez, I wrote this book, and I remember was when talking about his Hispanic upbringing. But, you know, that was my life at home. And then I had this other public life in school and then in my work life. And the two just never came together. And then suddenly I'm reading this book, and here is a novel that's about to be seen by however many Americans. And I almost felt exposed. I felt like, oh my God, they're going to know my life. And I didn't even know if I was ready for that. I wasn't sure I wanted it to be revealed, but there it was. And it was so moving. And I ended up getting in touch with Amy after I read these pages, and she started sending me chapters as she was writing them. And we got together in San Francisco.
So you got the movie rights then?
Well, not yet.
Oh.
Because the book hadn't even been published. She was still writing them. But I was so taken by the book, and I just stayed in touch with her through the writing of the book, through the publication of the book. And I just said, I don't know. I was such a baby person in Hollywood at the time. I said, I don't know if I can be helpful, but I'd like to see this get made into a movie, and I'll do everything I can. So I think just out of loyalty, Amy, you know, she knew I was one of the first supporters of this. And
you were one of the only Chinese-American individuals at the movie.
There were very, very few of us in Hollywood at the time. I was just a weird bird altogether. You know, people didn't know what to do with me because I was kind of, I had to have this background in China, and I was Chinese American. So, you know, the book came out, and lo and behold, it became a best-selling book, but it was still difficult to get off the ground. And it wasn't until I joined Oliver, when I was at Universal Studios, I did raise it as a potential project and was kind of shut down. And it did seem very risky because not only did it have an all-Asian cast, it was a lot of flashbacks, and that was considered a no-no in Hollywood, and a lot of it was going to be subtitled, and there were so many individual stories. It broke a lot of rules in addition to the casting, but it just broke a lot of
And there was nothing inscrutable or mysterious. The whole charm of that movie and what was so enlightening about it is that these were typical professional, young professional Americans trying to make it and yet get along with their parents who had somewhat different values and so forth. And this is before, I mean, now if you go to the University of California, Irvine, I don't know, sometimes people say there's more than 50% Chinese Americans, and the whole assumption that Chinese are very good students. This was sort of the beginning of that.
So there had been other books written about kind of a more southern Chinese, Cantonese, with a lot of ghosts, and that was, you know, China's a vast country, so there's many different subcultures, but there had been very few that I had never read any that were more from a different part of China and that came to this country not as blue-collar workers. So it was quite different, you know. Finally, when I was with Oliver, I said, this is something I'd really love to do. And his wife was reading the book at the time, and so he was supportive of it. But this now we had to go set it up at a studio. And we took it around. At that point, Wayne Wang had been attached as a director and Ron Bass as a co-writer with Amy. And we went to meet with all the different studios. And one person, Jeffrey Katzenberg, greenlit the movie. Everybody else turned it down because it was risky, you know. And he, I don't know what compelled him to to say yes. It broke every rule in the book. But back then, the studios took chances like this. I tell people that unfortunately in today's climate, this movie would never get made the way that it was made. The studios almost never do these. $10 million was considered kind of a mid-low level budget back then. And
is that what it cost to make?
Mm-hmm.
$10 million.
Mm-hmm. But it's the economics of Hollywood have changed so much, it would be virtually impossible to get a movie like this made today.
That's a landmark film. It's a film that people have been shown that film by members of their family. It's a rite of passage film. It's empowering. And what's interesting, however, is that it hasn't led to other films. We have endless films about Italian Americans, about Jewish Americans, about, you know, certainly and legitimately so, about African American culture and Latino culture. Yes, these are complex, vast cultural experiences, immigrant experiences that should be explored. But the idea that this, you know, fastest growing immigrant population in America now are Asian Americans, right? This is the group that is going to become an even more important demographic in the future. And this remains probably the only film that deals with that community in terms of angst, complexity, issues, struggle of generations, failing your parents, what is the meaning of life, what is being productive, you know, all of the things that go on in everyone's life, but was somehow stripped away from, particularly the Chinese American. They were supposed to be that person who was at first serving you in the restaurant, nameless, thoughtless, with no personality, or a character of mystery in some spy novel, and then ultimately the super-achieving, high-performing, technically competent person. And that movie smashed all of those stereotypes.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, it felt very authentic. It didn't pull any punches. It wasn't trying to exaggerate anything. It was just very beautiful, authentic voices and representing characters that a lot of people could relate to. You didn't have to be Chinese. I think what I've said in the past is that I think audiences like some familiarity and then something new. So they want to be able to relate. There has to be a level of relatability, but at the same time, it helps to feel you're entering a different culture or learning something that you maybe didn't know before. So I think it strikes that balance very well. And it is befuddling, and I think gets back to your point about China being a great boogeyman for a lot of people, certainly for politicians. And just culturally, there is this divide. And will East and West, is it never the twain shall meet, ne'er the twain shall meet, or can they come together? And those of us, many of us are in that space in between where we continue to believe doggedly that we can, there is a middle ground, that we can come together. There's so much, I mean, the statistics paint a completely different story that's not represented in media and entertainment. The number of people going back and forth, right here at USC, I don't know the exact number, but in this country alone, there's 300,000 students from China. They, you know, living in California, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, they're cities that feel at least, you know, a good part of it is very Asian. The culture, the cultural intermingling is so strong. And yet it remains very difficult to convince people that we are worth putting on screen. And it's a very sad fact because I think it's a vicious cycle. The more that we are not represented on screen, the more there is a divide and there's, you know, perpetuation of stereotypes. And I think if we were on screen more, it would affect everything. It would affect politics. It would affect business. However, the good news, I think, is that because China is such a big market, there is a better possibility now to find those stories, and there's more economic motivation to create those stories where we can be an integral part of a cast of a movie.
Thank you, Janet Yang. This has been a really interesting edition of Sheer Intelligence. Again, the intelligence comes from the guests. Our producers are Joshua Sheer and Rebecca Mooney. Our engineers are Kat Yor and Mario Diaz. And here at USC, where we're allowed to record and encouraged to record at the Annenberg School of Communications and Journalism, Sebastian Gruber did his excellent job of engineering. Thanks. See you next week.
Thank you, Bob.